This episode is brought to you by the New York Women's Culinary Alliance.
Hey everyone, I'm Marissa Ross.
And I'm Adam Horvulis, and we're the host of Natural Disasters.
It's a podcast about natural wine and shit. Every week we're going to be going through the basics, the ins and outs, and the culture around natural wine, and, you know, other shit that we just decided that we kind of want to talk about, but mostly wine.
Yeah, I mean, have you had that friend that has showed up to your house with a bottle of wine and gone, "This is natural wine," and you're like, "I wish I knew a little bit more about that," and was entertained?
Or maybe you're the friend that's like, "Yo, this is some natty wine," and you just want to learn more about said natty wine. This could be a good podcast for you too.
Or maybe you know everything about wine and you just want to listen to some really entertaining people drink wine and chit chat.
Yeah, we do a lot of that too.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I went to a Pusha T show recently. That was really fun.
That's pretty amazing.
It was great, except I was really looking for Kanye to come out, and then he didn't. And even though, you know, I'm still a little mad at him, but we don't need to get into that. Anyways, wine and shit.
Yeah, join us, Natural Disasters Pod on Heritage.
Yes, on Heritage Radio Network. It's the best. We're really excited.
All right.
Bye.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you're listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview an extraordinary woman on her path to success, her struggles, and learn something along the way. Today, I'm interviewing a writer and cocktail connoisseur at the heart of a monumental, and I imagine quite momentary, controversy, whether or not the Aperol Spritz is a heinous drink or a delightful one. We'll talk about this controversy and more with my guest today, Rebecca Pepler, who recently published a fantastic book called Aperitifs, Cocktail Hour, The French Way. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just start, because I can't avoid this controversy.
I can't either.
Stirred up by your piece in the New York Times with the title, "The Aperol Spritz is a Bad Drink." I don't have a very strong personal opinion, but I seem to be in the minority. So when you wrote the piece, tell me, like, what informed your thoughts about the Aperol Spritz, and then let's talk about the, you know, the results of that strong opinion.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was thinking about writing the piece, and I've thought about this a lot in the past few years, especially because I've been drinking so many low ABV liqueurs and spirits and all of that fun stuff.
And if anybody doesn't know what low ABV is?
Oh, low alcohol by volume. Pardon. Yes. So any of these that I talk about in the book, that there's so many that are French, and I live in Paris, and so it makes perfect sense that I would be writing something that is French-focused for the book. But I did include Campari and Aperol in kind of my history section of the book because they are a part of the conversation when you kind of go back to classic aperitif spirits. But it's just, you know, it's something that I think the marketing has just done such an incredible job at kind of equating a spritz with the Aperol Spritz. And so when you order a spritz, it's immediately this like bright orange, bubbly, really sweet drink. And the spritz itself has a history. It goes way, way back. It's named from the German word spritzen, which is spritz. And it was actually German soldiers that were occupying northern Italy weren't really a fan of the wine that they were drinking there. And so they added a spritz, or a spray of still water at that point, to the wine. And so it's got this incredible history that you can kind of go back on, and none of it has to do with Aperol. And so I wanted to kind of shine a light on that, and then also talk about, you know, drink what you want to drink. It's your body, it's your taste buds, it's your palate, it's your choice. But if you're going to make a spritz, make it good. You know, quality bubbles really matter, and I think that a lot of spritzes these days that are just served, like, you know, out in fresh air, and it's beautiful and it's sunny and everyone's tanned, and, you know, like, you have a crush on someone, and, you know, like, you're not really thinking about what you're drinking, they're not pouring great bubbles into these drinks. And so if you elevate that, you're already elevating the drink. And then there's all of these other, if you just want to stay in the category of red bitters, there's all of these other great brands that are doing such good work and not getting recognition because they're kind of getting passed over for a brand that has a lot of name recognition. And so I wanted to kind of throw a bone that way and be like, let's drink a little bit more responsibly and think about what we're putting in these super fun, low committal drinks.
Okay, but instead of you threw a bone, but you got attacked by the dogs.
I mean,
that's actually what happened.
I did.
Why did people just jump on you and tear you to shreds for this particular opinion that, as you say, it just seems so reasonable? And also, what's a better bubble? Just But first, why the dogs?
Yeah. You know, drinking a spritz outside in the summer is such an attainable fantasy. And I partake in it all the time. I love it. But I think...
Do they think they thought you were a snob?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think some opinions went that way. I think it was also
you really
just
hurt
like,
their feelings. Like, yeah, this is my drink and you just insulted my drink.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of... there's a lot of anxiety and fear going around right now in the world. And there's a lot of things that we can and should be discussing that are much more important than what we're drinking on a summer afternoon. But sometimes you have to let go of a little bit of that anger and frustration and fear, and we found an outlet here. And I think I wasn't expecting the outlet to be so pointedly personal. But at the same time, I'm happy to provide a little bit of a space for people to actually have a conversation that feels like it matters in a world that is feeling pretty scary right now. So
here we are. People feel like their drink matters a lot, but in fact, you're saying like, it's okay. It's not that important. And if you want to take it out on me and my drink, I'm good. And we'll talk about something next week.
It's distracting fun.
Yeah.
And happy to be a part of it. Okay. I need it as well.
So an aperitif is something that is a transition. Mm-hmm. And you talk about how the aperitif is, you know, the end of the workday in France, and is just before, just even saying these words makes me feel on vacation, but is before dinner. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to talk about some of the transitions that you've gone through, because you were a food stylist and still are.
I am.
and became a writer, which you were, but now it's more of your focus.
Yep.
And you had lived in Brooklyn, and you've moved to Paris and LA, and a bit parts unknown, since travel is such a big part of your life. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about transitions in the really big picture. And I think that I want to start with your transition from Brooklyn to Paris, from rooftop to rooftop.
Rooftop to rooftop, yes.
What drew you to Paris?
I mean, I think it's what draws everyone to Paris, right? It's a beautiful city. It's such a romantic city. Even if you've never visited, there's a fantasy that kind of goes right along with it. And I was ready for a change. I had moved to New York from Wisconsin, where I was born and raised, and went to university, and then was kind of looking at 10 years in New York and realizing, as a food stylist, also more than a writer, even though I studied journalism in college and really my passion is writing, I kind of felt like I was going to get stuck if I stayed. And I was single and, you know, unattached to really anything. And so I was like, I'm going to split my time because I can work from anywhere, especially as a writer. And it was actually between New York or between LA and Paris. And I kind of decided on Paris because you can always move to LA. It's so much closer, right? Well, technically it's like the same flight time, which is kind of crazy. But yeah, I decided that Paris was the right move. I was ready for a challenge. I wanted to learn a new language. I wanted to explore who I was in a bigger way. And it felt like I wasn't able to do that as fully as I needed to in New York.
But love was a part of the equation. Paris has love in the air,
but it does. You
found love in Paris. Can you tell me about that?
I did, yeah. So I decided to go for 6 weeks to see if Paris was the right place for me. And I decided about 4.5 weeks in that it was, and that, you know, in the next year I was going to like figure out the visa stuff and kind of move. And then I walked into a perfume shop and fell instantly in love with a woman, which was also a parallel surprise to me, since I had originally, or, you know, always kind of thought I was straight. And so kind of fast forward 6 weeks later, I was back in New York and had a one-way ticket back to Paris and kind of started the visa process a lot faster than I expected to.
So love was... It's like your speed starter. It was your bubbles to get the reaction going.
It was more of a crush than love at that point. We broke up very quickly after I got there. But I dug in my heels and stayed, and very, very happy that I did.
But what did that teach you about yourself? Like, in terms of, you know, moving on a dime, mm-hmm. and then, you know, digging your heels in, mm-hmm. and, you know, having revelations about your sexuality. Like, what, that just seems like there would have been a lot going on then.
Yeah. You know, I've always been like this. I jump into big things really easily. They don't scare me at all. It's the little things that actually give me more anxiety. But I have no qualms about, like, when I moved to New York, I made the decision while sitting on my mom's couch, and I was like, I'm doing this. I'm going to go to pastry school in New York. And she was like, great, wonderful. How can I help you fill out that application that you're looking at? And so all the big, big decisions that I've made in my life have been very, I wouldn't say spontaneous, but not fully thought out. And I think that's what has made them actually happen. Because if I overthink it, it actually doesn't happen.
What do you think gives you the freedom within yourself to do that?
I think it's a deeply rooted belief in myself, and that was instilled, you know, to give my mom another shout out, that was deeply instilled by her. She made me believe from a very young age that I could do whatever I wanted to do, and here I am doing it.
And what about the smaller things that give you more anxiety? Like, what type of thing, you know, can cripple you or hold you back? And you're like, come on, I moved to Paris, for God's sake.
Oh my gosh.
And I didn't know the language. I mean, you know, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And like, that seems big, but what small things would...
Yeah, when I like look through all of that, when I go back, I'm like, what were you thinking exactly? I can talk to my younger self and be like, that was actually a pretty bold, maybe stupid move. Oh my gosh, there's so many things. As a writer, I mean, I rewrite myself over and over and over again. I can stress over one sentence or one paragraph or one thing that I need to dig deeper into the history. And I think that comes from the journalism background that you see in Aperitif in the front section of the book. But I mean, like, you know, social interactions, like texting people that I have crushes on, like that kind of thing. Like, I definitely overthink those sides of things much more than big life decisions that are actually going to impact me in a larger way.
So you have an inner editor that stops you on the smaller things, but that editor's totally on vacation when it comes to...
Oh, yeah. She has her out of office on when I make a big decision or I come up with anything that might shift my life in a very big, dramatic way. It's just out the door.
And let's talk for a minute about the transition from journalism to food stylist to combining the two, really. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What drew you to journalism?
You know, I always wanted to write, and I did news editorial focus in university, but I knew that I wanted to focus less on hard breaking news and more on food, to be perfectly honest. But I didn't really know how to combine those two things in the city that I was living in at the time. And so I moved to New York to go to pastry school and kind of get a base understanding and connections in a bigger bigger pool for food writing. And so I always knew I wanted to write about food, but it took a while for them to kind of all come together. And then when I was in pastry school, I had an internship on a food TV show and ended up, you know, the executive producer kind of got behind me and she brought me on to her next project. And then when they were looking for a food stylist, she was like, you know, I think you'd be really good at this. I know you don't have any experience, but like, why don't we do it? I don't have a budget to hire anybody, and you can do your researcher role on the side and style these things. And so even that, it was just like I jumped 2 feet in. I knew the great part of it was, and I'm so grateful to Lauren for this, is that she...
Who was that?
Lauren Dean.
I love Lauren Dean.
She's amazing.
Hi, Lauren Dean.
Hi, Lauren. I love you. Thank you for everything. She she let me ask questions. She let me mess things up. There are, like, you know, horror stories that I'm sure she tells still.
Tell me one. I want to know.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't even know if she knows this, and this is outing me so much, but the first time I ever poached an egg was for camera on a Food Network show.
That's amazing.
No idea what I was doing. YouTube is, like, the best thing that's ever been invented in the entire world. I was on an electric stove in the back, like, didn't have an assistant, had no idea what I was doing, and was, like, swirling the water trying to figure out how to make it happen. And, like, fortunately, it looked great. But that could have been disastrous.
That could have been bad.
Yeah.
For sure.
And that was the time where I didn't tell anyone that I didn't know what I was doing. I was just like, no, I can figure this out. Like, you can figure out how to poach an egg.
Uh-huh.
But they don't teach you that in pastry school. Like, I know how to triple fold croissant. Like, I know how to make everything else, but, like, poaching an egg. But now I can do it. You know, weekday poached eggs are my specialty. So.
That's a really scary way to learn, I have to say. I can imagine myself back there going, like, is this going to work?
Truly, truly. Yeah. I'm sure that at the time I was texting somebody frantically at the same time. But in my head, I was just, like, very focused. So
you got this experience. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it was an unpaid working as a food stylist.
So that was actually paid. When I was an intern, it was unpaid while I was in school. And then when I graduated, I was working for Lord. It was low paid. I was an entry level researcher for a food TV show. So the pay matches that level. But yeah, it was great. The payment was in the experience itself. I'm very grateful for it.
And you became a food stylist, which wasn't what you expected to do.
I had no idea it was a job.
That's one of the things I love about this show, like introducing people to things that they don't even know is a job.
Oh, yeah.
So will you describe what a food stylist does?
Yeah. So in, like, very, very easy terms, a food stylist makes food pretty for camera. And so that's like the fancy part of it. It's like the person with the tweezers and the spray bottles and all the little, like, tools and gadgets and glues. But actually what a food stylist does is they prep for everything. They do all the shop. They schlep all over the city. I mean, when I was doing it in New York, I was, like, just covered in tote bags all the time. You're like,
a tote bag tree, right? A walking tote bag tree.
Right. And when you're working, especially for editorial work, everything is so far out in advance that you're looking for strawberries and it's January and you need a turkey and it's July. And so a food stylist makes food pretty for camera, but the behind the scenes work is actually the, like, bulk of the work.
And you're continuing to do it, but mm-hmm. you also pulled back from it.
I did. I really was missing flexing the part of my mind that was tied to writing and researching. And so I needed to kind of shift perspective. And I love food styling. I still do it. I styled my book, actually. It was so much fun. The photographer, Joanne Pye, was, like, the best to work with ever. She made my life very easy. But I needed something that felt more intellectual, on a more regular basis.
It's also, I mean, it's quite the hustle.
Yeah.
I guess both sides are a hustle.
But different hustles.
But the walking Christmas tree thing is, you know, I mean, that's just like,
it's a physical hustle.
It's a physical as well as, like, where's my next gig coming from?
Exactly. Oh yeah. And that's the stress of any freelancer, right? Like, that doesn't go away whether you're a writer or a food stylist or, you know, a novelist or any of these, I mean, I guess you can be a freelancer in anything now.
That's true.
But yeah,
hello, gig economy. But is there something that you think is essential to the personality of the food stylist?
Oh, yes. Organization. Yeah. I was very organized. You can ask any of the photographers or the videographers that I worked with. I really love Excel, lots of spreadsheets. I organize everything. I know when I'm shopping for specific things and make sure that they look good. I like to be able to, if there's a prop stylist that I'm working with, kind of go through everything and have those all lined up. And so, because when you're on set, everything takes longer than it's supposed to. And I try to kind of limit my adding to that.
So. Right. A well-prepped, you know, it's like the mise en place of life. And then
exactly.
Exactly. What's right ahead of you. So when you were talking about your book in an interview, you said that the images in this book exist in a world in which there are no cis straight white men. You're welcome and enjoy, which I kind of loved.
Thank you.
So I wanted to know, because we were also talking about that moment earlier in the show, when you get to Paris and you're like, I have this shift in mindset. Mm-hmm. And then looking at this quote and thinking about how it came to pass and how true it was in your book, I'm wondering what went into that feeling like it's an important thing, and then how did it
absolutely
happen?
Well, so when I was kind of doing the creative direction for the visuals in the book, I really wanted to reflect my experience in Paris / France with apéritif. I also kind of on parallel tracks wanted the book to not look like a classic cocktail book, because that's not what it is. I really wanted it to be evocative of the feeling of an apéritif, which is, like you were saying, this transitional cusp between day and night. I like to kind of describe the way French and Americans think about apéritif time is very different. So you can equate it to happy hour or cocktail hour, hence the subtitle of the book. In America, we kind of celebrate the end of the day, it's over. Where is my martini? Which I'm all for, and probably will be doing today. But in France and in Europe and European culture, with apéritif or apéritivo hour, it's more the celebration of the start of the evening. And there's this just shift in mindset that I really wanted to put into the photos. And then to go back to your original question, I think that especially the spirits world is very male dominated, and there's not a lot of women voices / not a ton of queer voices in it. And I really wanted to focus on those. And so that was in my decision to kind of include people that aren't being seen as much in this drinks world. And that doesn't include cis straight white men. So,
and how did, just give us some examples of how those people were seen who hadn't been seen before, because we've got a great opportunity to share the point of view and explain that.
Exactly. Well, it's great. The book, there's obviously a lot of cocktail shots because it is a cocktail book, although we did schlep all over the city for it. So there were, I carried 12 bottles a day to the Seine and then the Canal Saint-Martin, and we went to the park, and then we were up on my balcony, and it was just we were dragging terrace tables over to a better wall background. The cover of the photo is we dragged that marble table everywhere. And not to then to speak of the vintage glassware that I was also trying not to break. But I have this wonderful community of women and queer friends in Paris, and it was such a lovely opportunity for me to reach out and be like, hey, come out. Let's go do what we normally do and bring along a photographer, and I might kind of dictate what you're wearing or what your nails look like, but for the most part, it's going to be just a little bit more of a family vibe, and it was really nice to kind of bring that, and I think it comes through in the photos and the life that they kind of are really evocative of.
But also really dreamy.
Thank you. It's still Paris is a fantastical place in all the ways of the word.
But just showed me that your life there was dreamy.
Yeah.
And this is the people that populate your dreamscape.
Absolutely. And the city, it makes it very easy. We shot mostly in Paris. We shot up in Normandy at a friend's house as well. And I really wanted it to feel French and not Parisian specifically, although it still comes through because Paris is just such a part of the French fantasy.
And Paris is another character.
It is, and a wonderful one at that.
I was also interested in the notion of masculine and feminine in cocktails. So can you tell me what does it mean to have a masculine cocktail? What does it mean to have a feminine cocktail? Or what does that mean to you?
Yes, I think that's a subjective answer. But I think, in general, when you think of a feminine cocktail, you're usually thinking of a coupe glass or something that's daintier.
Something looks like a boob.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, there you go. A breast cocktail, if you will. Maybe bubbly, lower in alcohol, which the entire book is. There are no hard spirits in apéritif. In the book, not in the culture. And then a masculine cocktail is, in general, can be thought of as more brown spirits, heavy, heartier. And I just wanted to, I didn't want the book As much as I, as we talked about excluding cis straight white men from the visual narrative, I also didn't want the book to look overly feminine. And I think a lot of people, when they think of Paris, they kind of feminize Paris. And I wanted it to be a general neutral kind of look and feel. And so when we looked at typeface, when we looked at the kind of colors that we were going to be kind of focusing on, we wanted to be really careful to make sure that they all were gender neutral as much as they could be. And then even when I was doing like the cocktail, one of the cocktails, the Adonis, is one of my favorites in the book, actually. And that... the photo that kind of runs alongside of that is of me and my friend Lena, and I'm wearing like this like suit coat, or I'm in the back and I'm leaning on this lovely table, and the Adonis is like a stronger drink. It has sherry and vermouth, and it tastes like what you would characterize as a masculine drink if we were going there. And I wanted to queer it a little bit. I wanted to be like, yeah, here are two women, and like we're trying to create a story within each of these photos, because as a food stylist, that's also like part of my job, is to craft a story without using words. And so I did that within as many of the images as I could in the book. And that one, I think, is one of the kind of showcasing ones that really I tried to flip the masculine feminine duality on its head.
That I love the notion of, you know, being able to visually read the book mm-hmm. as a narrative story.
Definitely.
Which I suppose as a food stylist, that's what one tries to do. But mm-hmm. often there's so many other competing narratives.
Definitely.
That it can get lost. But yeah. In the case of this book, it is a narrative because it's you.
Yeah.
And the topic is quite narrow.
Exactly.
Like intentionally narrow. And exactly. How did you come up with the notion of doing aperitif as opposed to truly anything you could do in the entire world?
I know. Isn't that daunting when you're like, I want to write a book? And then you have every single option available and no ideas come to you. It was a really natural evolution. I moved to Paris. I wanted to write. I knew I was looking for something that would bring my new life into it, and all of a sudden I was getting asked out for aperitif from all of these people. I was meeting new friends, and you know, when you're new to a city, you're kind of always have to be going out and putting on, I don't know, it's kind of fun to present yourself in the way that you see yourself rather than the way that, like, when I was in New York, or when I am in New York, which we are now, I think I have friends that have seen me in the same way for so long. And so when I moved to Paris, I was like, ooh, I get to like show off who I am inside now. Like, it's not just this narrative that other people have.
Okay, I love that. Wait, so
I'm like going around your story around your question.
But I'm going to stop my original question for this because I think it's fascinating. Like, who is the Paris you, and what was the expectation of the New York you? And then there's the Wisconsin you.
Oh yeah. Oh, that is a different me. I mean, they're coming together much better now. I mean, in your 30s, I think you start to like kind of, they all weave a little bit closer. But yeah, I was trying things on for size, I think, especially like, you know, I'm from
New York.
In New York, yeah. When I moved from Wisconsin to New York, it was a very big shift in culture. And I was learning who I was. I was in my early 20s. I spent, you know, my entirety of my 20s here. So when I was finally in Paris, I was like, oh, who actually am I? And then you had this like underlying layer, not even underlying, quite large masking layer of who am I as a queer woman? And then who am I as a queer woman single in a country that I don't speak the language? But these are like questions that like I am so privileged to be able to ask and answer. And so then when I came back to New York, because at that point I was still splitting time between New York and Paris, it was very hard to bring my kind of new found self that I was still like, you know, getting my sea legs on back into a place that everyone knew who I was as a straight woman.
How'd that go?
You know, New York's wonderful. I have amazing friends here. Yeah. And it was very open. And I hadn't come out to I came out to people that I could trust. And New York is kind of like the people you trust.
Trust center.
And I came out to the industry here, and I didn't come out to my family for a while after that. And so Wisconsin me was still very much in the closet, but New York and Paris me was out, which was
And what was difficult. Your, were you afraid of your parents' reaction or family's reaction? Or
Family's reaction. I did come out to my mom. She came to visit me in New York. mainly because I said, I really need to see you. And she came for a weekend. And she knew before I even said anything, which I'm like, oh, Mom.
Mom, shout out number three.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, she's the best. Man, I won with her. So her reaction was a response, not a reaction. It was very loving and accepting and whole. But I do come from a very conservative town, a very conservative family. There's a lot of really intense religion in my background. And so that coming out was much more tumultuous.
And is it a tumult you had to live through, or did it happen in Wisconsin and you just could like be in Brooklyn or Paris and be like, you guys deal with that. And when you're ready, I'll talk to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Really. Yes. I came out in, while I was in Paris, I called the family to come out to them. It was just after the Orlando attacks, and I didn't feel comfortable keeping my voice silent when so many people had just died from being out and proud. And so I called, and it actually went really well, and then it went very poorly, kind of downhill. But yes, I was sheltered from it. I wasn't living at home. I didn't have to worry about my safety or my, you know, emotional well-being being that close to it. But it did take a while to be able to start opening the conversation again. For sure.
And was it really hard when you had the two selves? Like, you just know there are all these people who love you who really don't know you.
Yeah.
And then all these people who love you who really do know you.
Yeah.
And those things separate.
Yeah. I think that's a universal truth. I think there's always going to be that in anyone's life, especially a queer person that hasn't come out or has only selectively come out. But it wasn't easy, but it was what needed to happen at the time. And I think it was a growing moment.
But I also love that, you know, you feel all these yous, because we all do have so many us's.
We do.
No matter who we are, whatever the shades are, you know, coming together. And that's such a good feeling.
It is. It is. And it's nice when they kind of all start to come together and you're like, oh, this is really who I am at like the deepest root. And I'm liking it. So...
I'll drink to that, but yeah. I'm also going to take a break at that. And when we come back, we're going to go really deep and hard on aperitif because I have so much to learn. And I learned so much just from the book, but I learn better in, you know, when someone tells me things.
Excellent.
So we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, get ready for some great drink knowledge.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by the New York Women's Culinary Alliance, a vibrant and supportive community of professional women who work in all areas of the food, beverage, and hospitality worlds, and come together to network, learn, and share their passion. Membership is only open once a year, every spring, so now is the time to join. The deadline is Friday, May 31st. Visit nywca.org for more details.
Welcome back to Speaking Broadly. This is your host, Dana Cowan, and I'm here today with Rebecca Pepler, and we're talking about drinking, kind of low ABV. So it's not, you know, not too heavy, no hard alcohol on this in this conversation, which is something that I appreciate because I've actually gone very alcohol light myself recently.
Yes,
and
I get it.
I'm really enjoying that. I'm not that, I mean, like full disclosure, I've never went alcohol heavy because it would just put me to sleep or make me groggy. So,
yeah.
And I'm excited to talk about aperitif. And I'm also excited to talk about the fact that apero is a verb.
Yeah, isn't that fun?
I didn't know that. So people, they apero, like you could dance.
Yeah, or, it's like, do you want to go for apero? Do you want to apero avec moi? Like it can be used in a very different way.
Probably better
than, would you like an apéro? It's all these things.
Oh, it's many. I didn't know.
It's, yeah, it is.
And it was how when you moved to Paris, you got to know people.
It is, yeah.
Right? So they fully. Would invite you for, is that kind of like going on a blind date and people don't want to spend too much time with you, so they invite you for an apéro as opposed to like come to dinner?
Yes, it's perfect. It's actually, it's
low
like...
low commitment, low AVB.
Oh, it's perfect. Yeah, and for someone that has like social anxiety, you're like, oh my God, perfect. Okay, I have this like early evening drink that I can either extend because you can choose to keep drinking or go to dinner or whatever, but it's like fully within the culture that it's like just the snapshot in time. And so friends will meet for, I mean, as little as 20 minutes for like a quick beer by the canal, and then you go on to the rest of your night. Or you can be like, oh yeah, we're gonna apéro, and then we're gonna go to dinner, and then like, or we're gonna do apéro d'entoir, which is just like more apéros and more snacks.
Oh, right. And mm-hmm. and I think with in your book, you have both the aperitifs, but you also have some really delicious food.
Yes.
Not a surprise, since as we were talking about before, you are at the same time a food stylist. Mm-hmm. But they always come together, right?
Yeah.
There's always a little something to eat with Absolutely. A little something to drink.
Absolutely. Some of the recipes in the book are larger. But for the most part, like if you're taking aperitif, you're going to have a drink and then like some snack next to you, whether it's a big thing or a little thing, like bar nuts or a bag of potato chips or like something to like crunch on and like invite you to drink more and then eat more and drink more.
I'm curious because I actually love things that crunch. And
oh
some,
my God, yes.
I like things that crunch and I like things that are really creamy. Mm-hmm. The crunch part drives my family crazy because they have like oral, like they're really sensitive to the oral.
Oh, yes. I have had that in my life as well. I'm actually going to take a sip of water and make sure that I'm not offending anyone with that right now.
So I'd love to understand the entire category. Like, there are spirits that are appropriate for aperitif. You organized your book around like weather and seasons.
Yeah.
But I think I need to understand the basics before I get to the seasons.
Absolutely. We can start with one, move on to the next.
Thank you.
Yes.
So what is the base of an apéro?
So I'm going to back up even more.
Oh, really? Great.
Yeah. I'm going to get really
Take
basic.
Me back.
Yes. So aperitif can be used, as we were saying, as like, it refers to the drink. It refers to the bottle. And so, like we were talking about earlier, Sue's. So you can make a drink with Sue's, but also you can call the bottle of Sue's an aperitif.
Just to be clear, so, okay, we were like hanging out, mm-hmm. you know, before the audio went on, and I'm like, okay, I hate the name Sue's. Like, why is something called Sue's? And Sue's is, what is it exactly, aside from a woman's name and a river?
A river in Switzerland. Yeah, Sue's is a French aperitif. It's spirit-based, and so a lot of aperitifs are fortified, aromatized wines. We can get into that later.
Really good. Really getting deep here.
But this guy is grain alcohol rather than wine base. And so the bittering agent, so we'll talk about bittering things in aperitif culture, but the bittering agent is gentian root, which is this like gnarly root that looks kind of like something out of Pan's Labyrinth, like really crazy. It's bitter. It's like deeply bitter from root to top. It has beautiful yellow or blue flowers depending on the variety. And it's grown in the mountainous regions in France and Switzerland. And it's what gives Sue's its bright, bright yellow flavor or color and bitter flavor. And so Sue's is one of those that's like on the like deeply bitter spectrum of aperitifs and a little bit more, it's not like intro friendly. Like it's not going to be, you're not going to want to drink it like alone without kind of acclimating your taste buds. Right. But,
so was what you're saying to me that aperitifs, they're all mostly bitter.
Mostly bitter.
And there's the extreme, which would be Sue's.
And Sue's then they go to quite like extreme.
Less bitter.
Yeah, there's like, you know, a vermouth is an aperitif, and we can go further into vermouths, but there's plenty of different types, but a lot of them can skew sweet. If you're talking about sweet vermouth or Blanco vermouth, and then dry vermouth is its own kind of ballgame. But they still have like a bitter edge to them. Like vermouth is traditionally bittered with wormwood, which is also what you think of when you think of absinthe and the green fairy. But it's actually just it's a leaf. It's a silvery leaf that's grown in the fields in the south of France. It's deeply bitter also. I've put it in my mouth and been...
Spit it out.
Yeah. I've been like happy I did it for the experience and like sad for my palate for a good day or two. But yeah, so there, so bitter opens your palate. So we think of bitter a lot when we talk about Amaros because it's like it helps you digest. But it also, the same things that it helps you digest, like it creates saliva and it kind of creates these like your body, getting your body ready to like process things. It also opens your body up and gets it ready to like intake. That's a, it's a lovely, bitter is a lovely thing. It also, you know, alerts you for danger, but that's like a, that's older. And so a lot of aperitifs are, fortified wines that are infused with a bittering agent in order to give them that like little bit of an edge and open your palate, open your night, open your evening, open your heart. All of these, we go more poetic as we get closer to France. But for the most part, they do have a bitter edge. Although there's a section in the front of the book on vin du naturel, which is like sweet wines. And the French, it's a very historical thing to do. But you can open your meal also or your evening with a really sweet wine. And that will also open your palate and get you ready to kind of like intake the rest of your night.
Okay, so the biggest picture. We've got a little bitter edge and we're opening ourselves up.
Yep.
And are there an infinite number of these sort of base spirits?
Yeah. So when I was doing research for the book, so what we were talking about my background earlier, which is mostly on food. It's not in the spirit side of the industry, which was really interesting to me when I pitched this book because as a journalist, I wanted to research and travel. And I got to travel all over France in order to do it. So I wanted to focus on the history of apéritif and go from there. And so there are a ton new that are happening right now. But these base ones, this, you know, Suze, Lillet, all these vermouths that were started like in the 1800s, like were, are your kind of basic bar cart apéritif starters. There's one that's called Picon, which is like my favorite. Can't find it in the States at the moment, but you can come to France and smuggle a bottle back. You can find it at any Franprix. You can come in when you come in July.
I can come and drink some Picon.
Exactly. We'll have Picon beer. But so there's a limitless bottle list that you can do. I focus on the very historical ones. And then in the back of the book, I also list a bunch of bottles that I really love.
And so what are your favorites that are available here?
Okay, let's see. Well, I keep going back to vermouth, but vermouth is my favorite right now. I also just did a little holiday in Spain, so I might be like a little biased because it's vermouth central.
Are there trends in these? Because, you know, certainly at all that time at Food and Wine, like, you know, these spirits like Amaro, you know, was quiet, and then exploded.
Oh my God, yes.
Where are we in the spirits for aperitifs in, you know, quiet to exploded? Like people, where interests are.
Yeah, well, at the moment, spritzes. and I actually have an Amaro spritz in the New York Times article, which is one of, when I was testing all the recipes for it, I was back in Paris, and that was like that was the winner. And a really fun way to kind of introduce a traditionally classic digestif into your the start of your evening.
And also something in Italian into a French book.
I know.
They don't like each other, the French and the Italians.
They tolerate each other.
Okay.
And but they don't always love. Yeah. Yeah. They're very different mindsets culturally and, in general.
So if the Americans are like, oh my God, thank God my day's over. And the French are like, oh my God, let's celebrate the evening. What are the Italians?
Oh, they're just like partying all the time.
There's no distinction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I worked on a book in Italy a couple years ago, and we did. It was great. With Rolando Baramendi, we got to travel.
Him.
I know. Autentico is the name of the book. It's fantastic. He's an incredible guy and just so smart. But we got to travel all over Italy. And so, I mean, talk about drinking Amaro in every single place you possibly could. It was like I brought a few bottles back that I still like. There's like a tiny little quarter inch left and I can't give it up.
I thought one of the things that was interesting, a point that you made, was that aperitifs are great on a budget. And your drinking in the evening began partly out of budgetary concerns.
Absolutely.
Right? Like going out is really expensive and now it's really expensive.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. As a visitor coming back to New York, I'm like, oh, can we like, anybody want to throw a dinner party? Like,
right. Cause I mean, you're talking about $20 cocktails. So
truly,
with these bottles of spirits, they might be an investment to begin, but you use so little of them. Is that the budget idea?
Yeah. Yeah. It's and they also last longer. And so when you're buying a $20 bottle of wine, you have to drink it within, you know, four days, right? If you want to, right? But with fortified aromatized wines, which most of these aperitifs are, and then sous is like a whole other thing that can just live on your bar cart. They still need to be stored like you would wine. If you open it, it's going to start oxidizing. So put it in the fridge. Same with sherries. But they last so much longer because the fortification ups the alcohol content slightly and enough to kind of let it sit a little bit longer, and then they tend to be a little sweeter, and that sugar content helps as well.
So what do you put in the fridge? Like, do you put vermouth in the fridge?
Vermouth, no. Sherry, anything that's wine-based, beer, B-Y-R-R-H, but also B-E-E-R, you should probably put that in the fridge at some point.
Okay, so I've been doing something wrong for so long, and so have my parents, and so have my grandparents. Okay. So I come from a long line of people who've just left their vermouth on the...
Oh, of course. Everybody does it.
Out. But it's really good to, like, learn that right here and now.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, like... Vermouth bottles are so pretty too. I totally get wanting to leave them out. Like you don't actually want to put them away into a dark, dark fridge, but it is going to allow it to last longer. It's like leaving a bottle on the counter of wine on the counter versus putting it in the fridge. It's going to like give you a couple extra days to drink it.
Okay. Yeah. I'm very glad to have learned that.
Yes.
You also have really strong opinions about everything actually.
Yes, I do.
Crazy. But entertaining at home and like the meaning of solitude and inviting people in.
Ah, yes.
And I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, I love, I absolutely love to gather people in my home. It's such a treat and a pleasure and something that I do every Sunday when I'm in Paris. I have people over. But it's, I think it's the introvert side of me that really kind of nests in my home. Like I spend the whole day, like I get up, I go to the market, I go shopping, I have my whole plan because I'm a food stylist. So like I have it all written down. It's on Post-its. They're like stuck on the walls. And then I like, you know, I'll have an aperitif and I'll prep and I'll set my table and I'll get everything ready. And so when people show up, I'm ready for them. The doors can be opened. I can offer them an aperitif and a snack and maybe be finishing a few things in the kitchen. But I like the idea of having this whole time to kind of mentally and physically prepare for a meal with friends and then be able to take them in and host them rather than people. I know so many people my friends in the beginning would be like, oh, I want to come over and help. Like, what can I do? And I was like, please don't. Like, this is so much joy for me to host you. And when I come to your house, like, I would love to just show up with a bottle of wine and be wined and dined for the night. Like, that sounds like such a nice gift to be able to give and an easy kind of gift to give.
Okay, so how do you make it easy? Because I also love people in my home. And strangely enough, at Food and Wine, you know, cooking was a little bit more of a trauma and I made all these mistakes.
Of course.
Yeah. And now I'm just so much more aggressive with what I cook, which is very relaxing, actually.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to be less nervous and more aggressive. Mm-hmm. But I definitely have places where I trip up. Like, I hate making so many dishes. I mean, dirty dishes. And I always make so many things to be sure that every allergy is considered, every possible combination, you know, that someone could have is thought through. And I really overdo it. I am incapable. Like, I go to somebody's house and I feel like you do. I want to be wined and dined. And they do. They invite me over. They put a chicken on the table, a salad, some cheese. And they're like, here's dinner. I'm like, this is awesome. Like, I'm totally happy.
Exactly.
I'm going to be fed. I'm so happy to be here with you. I am characterologically incapable of doing that. But what version do you do?
So I skew towards chicken version. It depends on the day. You know, it really depends. Like, I love a good weekend activity, and I'll usually, one focus of the meal will be more involved. And it sometimes is dessert, because I absolutely love making dessert, and my background is in pastry. Right. And I don't get to flex those muscles as often as I like to. And so usually there's like some sort of kind of outrageous thing that's happening that no one wants to eat by the end because I've fed them so much food before.
Like what?
Layer cakes. You can't make layer cakes when you live alone. Like you have to you can, but then like I eat the whole thing. And so like, it's just so nice to make things like that. Playing with different flavors and shortbreads and cookies and like little things. I really do love if you have made a more extravagant main dish to make something very simple for dessert that's also portable. And so it's like, here's this and we're wrapping it up in wax paper and you can take it home with you. You don't have to eat it now. Or you can eat it. I want to start from the beginning, but I'll start at the end. My favorite end of a meal is when like the dishes are like dirty and kind of cleared, but you know, I don't like people clearing my dishes either. I'm like, don't clean up for me. I've got this. And I just throw a couple bottles of pastis, amaro, cognac, whatever people are going to be wanting to drink at the end of the meal, and a bucket of ice and tiny little glasses that you never know what to do with. Just throw those on the table, some cookies or like something sweet to snack on or dates or, you know, anything. And let people linger. And that's the best part of the night because you've all you've had your aperitif, your snack, your meal, your wine, and now you're just like digesting and everybody kind of opens up even more. And it's when you actually get into debates. And I think I instilled a kind of rule that if you're going to get up from the table, it's like get up from the table to go to the bathroom, whatever you need to do. But like, please don't clear for me. Don't clean up at the end of the night. That's my job. That's what I've
signed up for.
Exactly. And so once I've I created that culture with the group of people that I have in my home, it's just such a incredible evening. Like it feels like it lingers. It doesn't last too long, but it's just like really natural. No one feels stressed.
I love that.
So
I'm going to try that. I've never done that actually. And also, you know, people are like, I have to go to the babysitter. I have to take a flight tomorrow at 6 a.m.
Yep.
And so
start your night early.
I think that's it. Yeah. I got to start early.
I love a 6 a.m. dinner. I'm like, come on over.
Maybe
like,
6 p.m.
Yeah. Or 6 p.m.
Well, breakfast for dinner.
Breakfast for dinner.
Or dinner for breakfast.
Exactly.
Okay. I want you to teach me something. Teach me something in words that you know and I don't, but you think like, yeah, Dani, actually you should know how to do this.
So I'm going to, all my French speakers are going to hate me right now. But I have a toast that I'm going to teach you that I think it's one that I've been using for years and totally stole it off somebody else. It was a friend of a friend who said it at a big dinner. And I remember looking at the person that I was dating at the time and us both being like, this is it. This is what we're going to toast.
What is
to.
It?
So it's, may the best of our yesterdays be the worst of our tomorrows.
That's good.
Isn't that
okay,
great?
Okay, may the best of our yesterdays
be the worst of our tomorrows. And the dedication in the book is that in French, which I don't think I'm going to teach you because I so poorly teach you it, but you can take a peek.
I'm going to take a peek.
And it's not something you would ever really say in French. I had to get bunch of my fluent speakers to translate it for me correctly.
Que le meilleur de nos passés soit le pire de nos lendemains.
Exactement.
Ah, très bien. Okay, so I love that.
Yeah.
And last, I always ask to pay it forward. Mm. You know, the show is all about extraordinary women. We don't get to shine a light on talented people enough. Who would you like to pay it forward to today?
Oh, I'm going to pay it forward to Blake McKay, who is just the most fantastic publicist. But she was my first editor for the entirety of Aperitif, and her thoughtful commentary and notes really shaped the book in a way that I could never have written it the way that I did without her. And also just a dope publicist at the same time, so...
And a good friend. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
There's that shout out, Blake. Thank you all for listening to Speaking Broadly. Come on back next week if you like what you heard. Download us, rate us, review us, and come on back. You can find me at Speaking Broadly on Instagram. And where can we find you?
Rebecca Pepler on Instagram. Very easy.
Very easy. Okay, and go buy aperitif and make some. And think about that end of the night.
Yes.
Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.